Je vais juste donner le titre, mais vous l'avez à l'écran, de la communication d'aujourd'hui, hein, « Forming the Managerial Class ». Et donc, je lui laisse... Donc, c'est la deuxième conférence, il y en aura deux autres. Hein, vous avez le programme sur le site du Collège de France, j'aurai l'occasion de le rappeler. Je lui laisse la parole, Roger.
In the previous lecture, I tried to set out the need for managers, the nature of their work, and the diversity of their tasks. Much more about their work will emerge from the third and fourth lectures, but despite some risk of circularity, I turn now to ask how people became managers. What was the path by which parents might prepare a son for such a career, or by which a young man might move toward making himself useful in such roles? Even these questions suggest a level of intentionality in such formation that might not seem self-evident, not to mention an abstraction of the concept of management, which is largely a modern creation. But from the extensive work on ancient education carried out over the past quarter century, we have a better idea in some detail of how a literate stratum of society was created, and we can begin to see how the formation of a managerial class fitted into that process. We must begin by acknowledging that not all managers needed to be literate. And it is probable that a considerable number of those who exercised managerial functions had no education at all. In particular, two groups are likely to have had no deliberate formation. First, the extensive bodies of hired laborers in agriculture, whose existence has been demonstrated in Christel Froese's recent book, undoubtedly had foremen, field supervisors. There is no reason that these men would have had to be literate, although they certainly reported to superiors who were. Secondly, entrepreneurial village landowners, like Aurelius Isidorus of Caranis, who is consistently described as illiterate, can have acted as the agents of urban landlords in managing their village properties without being able to write. They relied on others for this skill. It is self-evident that these groups of lower-level managers would have had only an oral formation, mostly in the form of learning on the job, and that this would naturally leave no evidence. What follows is therefore of necessity limited to the literate part of the managerial population, and thus emphasizes the link of higher and more professional management to written culture. The early stages of education are by now fairly well known, particularly from Raffaele Cribiore's detailed analysis of the school exercises. She rightly distinguished between learning to write and learning to read, and showed that some pupils practicing writing seem not to have been able to read when they first began writing. That suggests that learning to write the letters came first, then alphabets, syllabaries, words, and on up through passages, with reading following, although probably at no great distance at each stage. This literate capability was clearly the common foundation for all more advanced learning. Cribiore's work focused on the continued trajectory from the letters through the work of the grammarian's classroom, where much more detailed study of texts and formal study of grammar provided a foundation both for understanding classical literature and for writing serviceable Greek prose and poetry. The centrality of poetry in late antiquity is particularly striking, and perhaps hard for people today to understand, although even a generation or two back, poetry, and particularly memorization of poetry, played a much more important role in education than it does today. My sisters and I well remember as children having to memorize poetry and recite it to the rest of the family. Perhaps this experience led me to a lifelong preference for prose. A small minority of those educated to the level of the grammarian went on, if they had sufficient ambition and means, to advanced rhetorical training. Beyond a certain point, this was likely to mean moving to a larger center, and for the most advanced work, to Alexandria. We should keep in mind, however, that the division between stages of education was far from impermeable, and rhetorical composition could be taught in classrooms a good deal more humble than that of a big city rhetorician. We find a likely example of this fuzziness of lines in the classroom excavated at Trimethus in the Dakhla Oasis, with rhetorical verse on the walls of an unimposing school in a modest-sized city in a remote location. But rhetoric was a path for the few. It was intended to prepare young men for leadership, not for management. Broadly speaking, the members of a grammarian's class are likely to have belonged to three groups. First, members of the local upper class, the 100 families or so that made up the city councils of third century and later metropolis, and that even before the cities were granted councils under Septimius Severus, held important local offices. Not all of them sought advanced education, certainly, but is in their midst that we should look for the more bookish members of society. Secondly, those destined for managerial roles. We shall devote most of our attention to these, obviously. But as we shall see in the next two lectures, these first two groups overlapped in that members of the Bouleutic order sometimes managed property for others and not only themselves. And third, those who were to become professional writers, a status often referred to in modern literature as that of scribe. This is a term I tend to avoid because it has been used to designate almost anyone who used writing in earning a living. And that looseness of usage is precisely what has helped hide the managerial class from our eyes. But there were professional writers, some of whom specialized in copying books, and others who wrote documentary texts and official records. We have an unusual reference to the latter group in a Michigan papyrus dated to 134, in which nine men who identify themselves as grammates contract with the grammates of the metropolis, that is, the city secretaries, to copy a number of government records. We can see that the use of a single term, grammateos, to mean both copyist and civic official, a usage that does have deep roots in Egypt, shows that moderns were not the first to muddy the picture with an indiscriminate use of terms. The ancients were also guilty of using a single term to describe two quite different roles. All of the documents to be copied under this agreement have to do with data from the census of 131-132, the declarations of which would have been submitted mainly in 133. This is, we learn, a follow-up agreement to an earlier one and adds additional categories of records. The editor believed that their work consisted of composing the various registers, which included lists of males subject to the Lao Graphia, the list of katoikoi eligible for a reduced rate, lists of minors and others excluded from the tax, and summary lists of the poll tax. But he admitted that he could offer no parallel for such a usage of antigrapha, the term used. What they agreed to draw up, the verb is synthenai, is in fact described as mona antigrapha. And I believe this can only mean copies of existing records. These were then pure copyists. As far as we can tell, there was no fixed period for any of these groups to stay with the grammarian. All three had some use for a firm grasp of Greek and some knowledge of literature. But the needed knowledge was not defined in any of these cases. Family resources and need will have been the deciding factors. Obviously, professional copyists needed to devote more time and effort to mastering handwritings. Although we rarely have any evidence to help us understand their capabilities, some copyists may have specialized in one type of writing or another. While others maintained competence in more than one style, perhaps even all three of literary, epistolary, and documentary. Cribiore discusses a number of texts that she regards as representative of advanced development of handwriting skills by prospective copyists. It is also possible to see that some of those destined for a managerial career practiced more than one style of handwriting. An example cited by Cribiore is a letter from the Herennius Archive, in which Timaios, with a splendid literary name of his own, a member of the central office staff for the estate located in Arsinoe, writes to Herennius. The letter itself is in a fine, nearly bilinear, detached hand, highly legible even for an epistolary hand. But in the margin, at left, as you can see, written perpendicularly, is a two-verse quotation from Book Two of the Iliad, self-consciously written in a more book-style script. I would not regard it as a true book hand, but it is evident that Timaios had some experience writing such hands and knew what to aim for. That certainly suggests that his education had exposed him to multiple forms of handwriting up to a certain point. As Dominic Rathbone has pointed out, five letters in the archive were written on the backs of fragments of literary texts, not only Homer, but Demosthenes, comedy, and philosophy. We do not know quite how they came into use by these central managers, but it is clear enough that literature was not absent from the worlds of these men. So the term scribal has been used in a variety of ways in the scholarly literature, reflecting unintentionally, perhaps, the incoherence of the concept of the scribe and perhaps the undifferentiated ancient usage that I have already mentioned. In Cribiore's Gymnastics of the Mind, for example, the term, quote, specialized scribal schools, unquote, is used for the setting in which students acquired a detailed knowledge of multiplication and fractions. This term does rest on an important factual observation that she made. Mathematical exercises are almost never written in the handwriting of beginners. They reflect a reasonably advanced state of competence in writing. She hypothesizes, almost certainly rightly, that more elementary arithmetical exercises, such as addition, subtraction, and basic multiplication, were carried out orally in the classroom at an earlier stage. The mathematical texts that we do have in some abundance, in which tables of fractions or division are prominent, certainly do not reflect only an elementary education in handwriting. And we shall see that the same is true of the more complex texts, focused above all on geometry. Before we turn to that aspect of education, however, I want to pause just for a moment to ask where the term scribe may appropriately be used, if it is not to be a catch-all for people who used writing in the course of their occupational labors. The grammates of the Michigan papyrus that I showed you earlier seemed to me to belong in this group. Let me look at them again for a moment. Their work consisted of copying official records in appropriate handwriting, which in this case, if we may judge from all of our surviving examples of such records, must refer to the flowing cursive hands of the type we conventionally call documentary. The agreement itself, to bring it back, is written in such a hand, although it's not really a particularly good advertisement for the quality of the work of these secretaries. The notaries who were paid 10 denarii per 100 lines of petitions or legal documents, according to Diocletian's Edict of Maximum Prices, must exemplify this occupation. And in the absence of mechanical processes for making large or small numbers of copies, the requirement for such services remained important, down to the introduction of printing, in the case of large numbers of copies, and for smaller numbers, really until the development of carbon paper in the early 19th century, and even beyond until the wider use of typing, and then that great invention of my youth, photocopying. But the term scribe is also used, and perhaps more commonly, for those who copied books for a fee. This is, in fact, how Diocletian's edict uses it, decreeing maximum rate wages for the best quality writing of 25 denarii per 100 lines, and 20 denarii for second quality. Given that bookhands were much slower work than rapid cursives, the disparity may reflect not so much the skill of the writer as the time occupied in carrying out the work. What is essential is the recognition that such writing constitutes a specific professional skill. Unfortunately, it is not easy to recognize the stages in the acquisition of this skill because it is virtually impossible to distinguish, particularly with fragmentary examples, between practice in copying a literary text in such a hand for the purposes of exercise and actually copying a literary text as part of producing a book. We cannot estimate the time involved in moving from the level of skill that Timaeus shows to what we find in the higher quality literary papyri. And of course, not everyone was willing to pay for the best quality copying either. Our literary papyri, in fact, show a wide range of quality in their handwriting, not a simple division between professional and private. Now, to return to our main subject, the education of those for whom handwriting was not a profession in itself, but only a tool in the pursuit of some other ends. My conception of a managerial class does, of course, include a variety of different jobs and their duties, and indeed a variety of the statuses of the holders of these jobs. Probably no two people faced exactly the same needs in their work. Of necessity, I omit from consideration much of what is taught as part of business education today, because it can have left no written traces for us to study. How do you get tenants to pay their rent? How do you go about collecting money taxes in a village? What is involved in negotiating the sale of a large quantity of wine to a wholesaler? How do you manage a staff, including both permanent and temporary workers? Where can you get short-term loans? The list can be multiplied almost without end. And of course, one may recognize in it subjects that business schools today call strategy, marketing, operations management, labor relations, price management, government regulation, leadership, motivation, and finance. These are, even now for the most part, at their heart matters of dealing with people. And we have no reason to believe that they were taught in a formal educational setting in ancient times any more than they were in later periods before the rise of modern business education in the 20th century. For the most part, they were surely acquired through experience on the job, as they still are today for most people. Indeed, it is not hard to find skepticism today about the value of the more abstract teaching of these subjects in business schools. Well, how much does this matter? It is not difficult to be cynical about the value of modern business education. Many graduates of business schools are. But even that critical stance on the part of those who have experienced such education may reflect the active and critical approach to work that much else in modern Western education is aimed at developing. If one tried to summarize a single core characteristic of business education today, it would in fact be the inculcation of an activist and reflective approach to the task of running an enterprise. This style of education assumes that students are being prepared for eventual leadership positions at the top of the ladder, rather than merely carrying out required operations. That approach is probably not new in the 20th century, but there is no sign that ancient education saw it as an important part of being prepared for life as a manager. Whether this mattered is hard to say. We are not in a good position to judge the effectiveness of ancient management. Even the best-known enterprises, such as, let's say, the late Roman government bureaucracy, have been evaluated in highly conflicting terms by modern scholars, generally on the basis of little or no data, rather gut feeling. The ancient focus was thus more on technical skills needed in the job. Managerial work did involve a number of types of operations that required writing. Among them were the following. First, letters, the principal means of communication, and an essential way to determine prices and availability of goods. In effect, the making of markets, as Patrick Reinhardt has shown in detail, but also an enormous amount of day-to-day management of estates, enterprises, and government operations. Communications in letter form were so fundamental and used for so many purposes that even defining the concept of letter has become difficult. We have no reason to think that the contents of letters formed the object of formal education, but the form and structure of letters certainly did. Second, accounts, ranging from the simple daybooks of transactions to more analytic and systematic accounts in the case of at least some operations, such as the Appianus estate, as studied by Rathbone. The arithmetical operations involved, which are generally simple, were certainly taught in schools, as I said, but not in a way that has produced any surviving textual documentation. Third, basic legal documents, leases, loans, receipts, and the like. These often have elaborate formulas and have enough similarity among examples, as well as local variation, to suggest that standard formulas were readily available in particular places. There's evidence for the use of model documents in education, as we shall see. Practice in writing dating formulas, Christian inscriptions, and bits of documentary formulae is fairly well attested in the late antique papyri. Some of these are actual accounts in which the blank space has been used to practice such formulae. It is far from easy to tell in many cases in what setting this happened. Fourth, estimates of amounts due in rent and taxes. These required, in some cases, calculation, applying rates to areas of land, and in others, extracting agreed-upon amounts from underlying documents such as leases. The more advanced mathematical texts that survive may reflect the training that allowed the intellectual activity behind such documents. The land surveys themselves were certainly the products of surveyors with specialized training that falls outside the typical school curricula that we can discern. Surveyors must have been trained by surveyors. But managerial staff, particularly in government offices, are likely to have been critical in converting the results of such surveys into the records on which tax assessments were based. I'm not aware of any papyri that can be identified as part of training in such work, and it is likely that it took place inside the government offices in question, because rent levels in private agreements were set by negotiation and contract rather than by complex negotiation. In the fourth lecture, however, I shall discuss some ostraca that may be part of the use of this kind of education by managers. Fifth, calculations of materials and labor needed for projects involving irrigation and construction. There are a few famous examples of such computations, such as the one from the Archive of Zenon, containing dike and ditch construction, but perhaps fewer such texts than we might expect. That such computations were necessary, however, and part of the educational curriculum will become clear from evidence that we will be coming to shortly. Except for letter writing, none of these formed any part of the general curriculum that we know of. And yet all of these were crucial for at least some part of the managerial class. This was not an aspect of education that elite ancient authors saw any reason to describe in their works. And our access to such education comes entirely from a modest number of texts that survive from this educational process. Nothing, in other words, allows us to cross-reference theoretical and practical texts in the way that we can with literary and rhetorical education. Into this discussion, I introduce a codex that my colleague Alexander Jones and I published recently. Its 12 leaves are divided between the Princeton University Library and a private collection in the United States. And we know that it originally contained at least 5 more leaves when it was first examined by scholars. Indeed, when I first saw it in 1984, before it was divided and mutilated by the dealer Bruce Ferrini of despicable memory. We do not know if the other 5 leaves survive, where they might be now, or what they contained. The codex, as we have it, dates, we believe, to the 360s and comes from the Oxyrhynchite Nome. It contains 3 types of material in no particular order as far as we can tell. Even though the precise order of the leaves remains uncertain, on no hypothesis can we make the codex systematic. These 3 types are metrological texts, mathematical problems, and model contracts. The mathematical problems dominate the codex. Most are problems of plane or solid geometry, although there are some curious partitioning exercises that I shall not discuss, except to note that they may have helped develop skills in working with fractions that would come in useful in dealing with fractions of an arura. 3 of the texts in the codex, of which only one is fully preserved, are model contracts. 2 of these are loans of money. One of them. And the 3rd is an undertaking to lease arable land. Now, what do I mean by the term model contract? Model contracts are to be distinguished from actually executed contracts, which should have contained official dating formulas by the consuls in the period to which we assign the codex, and the subscription of the acknowledging party or parties and of their hypographos in the case of an illiterate party. Actual contracts also stand on separate sheets of papyrus and are not simply portions of a contract, of a codex. Because we have the endings of all of these model contracts, we can be certain that they lack the concluding elements needed in actual contracts. Somewhat more complex is the distinction between a model contract and a draft of a contract. An example of a draft contract, or in this case, a writer to a contract, has recently been published with a detailed commentary by David Ratson. Like our model contracts, this lacks the elements of execution, including the subscriptions that would be needed in actual contracts. But unlike them, it does not attempt to include the names of parties at the start, instead starting baldly with Cairene. It is thus pure draft legal language. In contrast, in one of the 3 models in the codex, we have the names of the parties, even if imperfectly preserved and presumably fictitious. And it is clear that they also stood in another one. The question of distinguishing actual from model contracts is not always simple, however, particularly with the presence of elements like the names of the parties. This issue was confronted already by Rosario Pintaudi and Pete Seipestein in the introduction to the volume of wooden and wax tablets in various collections. They noted in the tablets some cases of, quote, scribes with a certain experience in handwriting, unquote, but also sometimes dreadful spelling. Even if, though their tablets looked like real contracts, there's one of them, none actually had all of the necessary parts. And they thus stuck to the hypothesis that these were of scholastic provenance, written by the teacher so that the students could copy them and acquire confidence in the formulas and situations like those of real life. When they wrote 30 years ago, the corpus of comparable texts was small. For example, P. Rainer Unterricht, in the 108 in the 7th century, was the only really similar text available. There, as in our codex, we find a fluent, if somewhat careless, hand coupled with poor spelling. But the analysis given by Pintaudi and Stiepenstein remains mostly sound. We can add, with the benefit of the material provided by our codex, that the combination of model contracts with texts of other types, including mathematical, in a codex appears as a diagnostic element for the scholastic use of the texts, and thus their model character. This is particularly striking in the case of the tablets, if one takes into account the probability that the tablets in the Pintaudi-Stiepenstein volume and others cited by them belong to a single find, a large part of which was school tablets of one sort or another, many of them mathematical, including tables and problems. Because that tablet find belongs to a much later period than our codex, as you can see, the 6th and 7th centuries, the codex adds importantly to our knowledge of the use of model contracts in the school curriculum. It is significant to note that only one of them concerns an area of land, a type of business transaction in which one might suppose a direct relationship with the geometric knowledge that the mathematical problems tried, not always successfully, to convey. In addition to the codex I'm talking about here, there are more such model contracts recently published or awaiting publication. One is a late antique Panopolite codex, late 5th century, in the British Library, and another is a series of tablets in the Yale collection. The Panopolite codex is in the process of being edited, and the Yale tablets have just had their appearance announced. These model contracts have their own characteristics, which I'm not going to try to describe here, but they help to show that the model contracts we already have are not to be seen as something extraordinary and isolated. 44 mathematical problems are included in the codex, most of them complete or with enough surviving so that we can recover what is to be solved, the method of solution, and the results. This is not quite the largest collection of problems in a Greek papyrus. The Achmim Codex in Cairo has 50, so it edges it out, but it is the most varied collection and particularly rich in geometrical problems. The student was expected to come to master a repertoire of algorithms applicable to a variety of general scenarios, such as algorithms for finding the area of a rectangle or of any quadrilateral figure once given the sides. Others are for solids of various shapes, including cylindrical, conical, and truncated conical sections. For the most part, they use units of measurement familiar to anyone working with land in Roman Egypt, and which are included in the metrological pages. Some of them are connected with excavations of amounts of earth for canals or for embankments. Others seem less directly practical, but it would take us too far afield to discuss these in detail. Of those concerning areas, they divide roughly between quadrilaterals of various sorts and triangles. The volumetric problems include a tower, where the number of bricks required is computed, granaries, pits, a vat, a canal, a breach in a dike, and some that aren't quite clear enough in their preservation. What is this codex, and who was responsible for it? Despite all the information that we have elicited and compiled, the answers to these questions are not immediately obvious. We initially, following Pintaudi and Stiepenstein's hunch, thought that it might be a teacher's compendium of material. But we have found this hypothesis more and more difficult to defend as we looked carefully at its characteristics. First, we are missing part of the codex, and in all likelihood are lacking the opening pages. If there were any indications of authorship or ownership in its original state, and there are often such indications in education-related texts, particularly tablets, they're lost. What remains does not have any obvious organization. The model documents may have been roughly grouped, but we have no clear evidence that they were, or what might have preceded them. There is no progression in terms of subject or of difficulty either. This is certainly not a systematic compendium of any kind. Secondly, the handwriting is fairly fluent and even at times stylish. If the model contracts and the mathematical texts are all by the same hand, but in different styles, this suggests someone with enough education to have acquired a reasonable level of skill in writing, but by no means a completely fluent documentary script. Moreover, there's a high level of inconsistency in the writing, and the layout does not always make a good impression either. The level of spelling errors is high, and there are many inconsistencies, which do not all trend in the same direction. Most are explicable as the normal phonetic variants that we know and love from documentary and epistolary papyri, where people are writing words down just the way they heard them. There is no sign of the command of spelling that should have been acquired in a grammarian's classroom. More damagingly, there are many errors that are not phonetic and that indeed suggest a failure to understand the text at all. Some interchanges are unparalleled in the papyri, no matter how you thumb your copy of Gignac. They are not phonetic in character. Some might be failures to understand a character and thus to copy it correctly. The morphology is at best mediocre, and in many instances the case endings are wrong. Again, this is a sign of a lack of literary education above the most elementary level. The arithmetic, in contrast, is unfailingly correct, but this skill in computation is often applied in the service of mistaken algorithmic procedures, to the point of nonsense in some cases, as in one problem where four dimensions seem to be envisaged. And no, the fourth dimension is not time. The diagrams attached to the problems are often wrong, or even completely disconnected from the data in the problem. The writer cannot be said to have made up for a weak literary grounding with a high level of experience in geometry, or even to have paid much attention to what he was doing. Taking all of these characteristics together, we believe that the most likely explanation is that the codex belonged to a student in a school devoted to training business agents and similar professionals. Much of it may have been copied by eye rather than from dictation, but there are elements of both processes at different points, and the exemplar may itself have been the result of things taken down by ear. It is perfectly conceivable that a student took down information on tablets in the classroom, then made an intended fair copy onto papyrus at a later time. Such a papyrus process could account for the mixture of types of errors in the codex. It would also be a plausible setting for the habit, visible in many places, of beginning a section with some ambition for elegant presentation, but gradually becoming less and less in command of the writing as time went on and line succeeded line. Such initial ambition followed by tailing off can, of course, also be seen in many private letters. Our codex thus fleshes out the picture given by Raffaele Cribiore, which I quoted earlier, importantly suggesting that model contracts, metrological information, geometry, and some types of fractional computation all were part of an education that was indeed separate from that of the grammarian and did not presuppose any meaningful time in a grammarian's classroom. At the same time, it reinforces my sense that scribal is not the best term for an education that aimed to inculcate a number of skills relevant to the administration of land, rents, and taxes, skills that would have been equally relevant for the agents of liturgists who had to assess and collect taxes, and for the stewards of the estates of large landowners. Quite possibly the same managerial people at different times, in fact, as after all, the larger landowners were the liturgists. It is worth bringing Chester Beatty Codex 1390 into the discussion, although I can't say it makes matters simpler. This single choir codex, quite possibly from a larger original manuscript, contains mathematical problems along with a portion of the Gospel of John in sub-achmimic. Brent Nongbri's careful investigations have led him to conclude that this codex was part of the same find as the Bodmer papyri, and that this find probably does come from the Tenturite gnome. It dates to the second half of the 4th century. Its mathematical problems, edited by William Brashear, are similar to those of our codex. Computing the number of naubia in a rectangular trench, the number of artabudas that a granary will hold, and the areas of fields. There are also numerical talents, problems involving talents and myriads of denarii. The Coptic text of John, edited by Wolf-Peter Funk and Richard Smith, begins just before the end of chapter 10, verse 7, right below the end of mathematical texts, with a line drawn between them. As the editors say, this is, quote, an excerpt written in a casual hand, apparently undecided between a semi-uncial and an almost fully cursive style, unquote. That is, it is not a professionally made literary manuscript. Brashear leaves open the question of who produced the mathematical texts, but he notes the facile expert writing, which is indeed a rapid documentary hand, and although the orthography is not flawless, it is vastly better than in our codex. We might therefore be more inclined to see it as a copy produced by someone more advanced, perhaps a teacher. Nonetheless, there are some sheer blunders that suggest lack of comprehension or care, and from these we might be led instead to hypothesize a student who had been through more years of grammar school before reaching the point of reaching these problems than the person who wrote the Princeton and whatnot codex. The combined presence of mathematics in a Coptic gospel extract obviously demands explanation. But this is not a demand easily satisfied. The gospel fits easily into the larger framework of the Bodmer papyri, as does the use of Coptic. But the mathematics are less easy to explain. Although Nongbri also accepts the likelihood that Chester Beatty 1499, which has Greek conjugations along with a Greek-Latin lexicon of the Pauline letters, was part of the find, and that also can be attributed to an educational milieu. Nongbri has dismissed from the Bodmer find all of the items with a specifically monastic, i.e. Pacomian, character, so we are not obliged to think that this educational setting was monastic. I've been dealing here with material of the 4th century and later. One might reasonably ask if the type of education for which I am arguing was in fact limited to the written culture of late antiquity. In the case of mathematical and metrological texts, there is sufficient evidence from earlier in the Roman period, at least from the 2nd century, to show that these were not new concerns. Many are too fragmentary for a detailed analysis to be able to show whether they came from an educational milieu. But at least one can say that texts of this kind were in use and were being copied much earlier than our codex, or the Chester Beatty Codex, or the Achmim Codex. The handwriting seems sometimes more careful than in our codex, as you can see on these pieces from P. Reiner Unterricht, and on occasion, one might even say somewhat stylish. spelling is also often much better. With model contracts, it is harder to make this case. I do not, in fact, know of any examples dating before the 4th century. That does not mean that we don't have any. Many surviving contracts are so fragmentary that we cannot say if they had the elements that would have completed them, and we do not know that draft contracts go back as far as the 1st, 2nd century, the date of the draft published by Ratzin. In a broader sense, it is obvious that the more extensive school texts that we have belong to a late period. Far more wooden tablets have survived from the 4th to 7th centuries than from an earlier period, and papyrus codices belong to this period as well. School texts from earlier centuries tend to use scraps and to be less expansive in their character. How far all of this is a matter of factors affecting preservation, and how far it reflects underlying trends in education is hard to say. The use of notebooks may well have increased in later periods. With the model contracts, we have virtually none except from notebook contexts, and we cannot say whether the contents or the format plays a larger role in that pattern of survival. As a codex to these observations, it is interesting to look at the large collection of Coptic educational texts compiled by Monica Hatschitska. There are many exercises in arithmetic, numbers, addition, multiplication, and fractions, but none in geometry. There are many practice texts for writing letters, but none demonstrably of contracts. Some cases of invocations are treated as possibly having belonged to contracts, but there is no reason that any of them could not have been intended for letters. Although, for unexplained reasons, Hatschitska labels one well-written example as an Urkundenformel. The entire curriculum that we find in our Oxyrhynchite Codex seems not to have made the transition to Coptic, and this despite the fact that so many of our Greek school exercises belong to a late period, and of course the fact that we do have Coptic contracts. To conclude, as Raffaele Cribiori has stressed, our ability to distinguish analytically different stages of education and types of teacher should not lead us to imagine that schools actually had formal grades, departments, or specialized teachers. She quotes in this respect a second century letter in which a student writes to a friend and former fellow student who is in the Arsinoite, asking him for a papyrus that will help him deal with the geometry problems that he has been given, and which he is finding challenging. The address given is the Grammatodidaskaleion of Melanchomus, where the friend is supposed to be. As Cribiori remarks, it seems likely that Melanchomus was an elementary teacher whose functions were somewhat fluid. Melanchomus, in other words, may not have been only a teacher of elementary letters. In a village, perhaps Philadelphia, where the name was common, he may have taught whatever was needed. Or perhaps he was simply interested in geometry and had himself been educated to a higher level. At the same time, it is clear that although geometry was not part of the elementary curriculum, those who wrote out geometry problems were not all at the same stage of improving their handwriting and spelling. In other words, we cannot imagine a neat parting of the ways when some students continued on to the grammarian, others worked only on handwriting, and yet others started work on contracts and geometry. The unpredictable collocation of the Coptic gospel and mathematical problems in the Chesterbeedi Codex suggests that 4th century schools did not have neat divisions of this kind, not even really between Greek and Coptic. I should say I do reject James Robinson's suggestion, adopted by William Brashear, that this codex had been acquired by a monastery with just a few of its pages already used for geometry. That idea was invented to support a preconceived notion about the provenance of the codex. So students might be doing more than one track simultaneously, Or they might break off from the grammarian's path at different moments. For now, that remains obscure to us. Despite all of the things that do remain obscure to us, what seems clear is that Roman Egypt prepared some set of those who were to keep the wheels of production, commerce, and governance in motion by teaching them a limited repertory of specific skills: reading and writing, geometry, and the forms taken by letters and contracts. Some of them were well trained in these, others poorly. The wide range of spelling, grammar, and geometrical competence that we find in the papyri makes this unmistakable. But there was no sense in which the more leadership-oriented side of management was formally taught in a world where political leadership itself was in the hands of rank amateurs. So this can come as no surprise. Thank you.